Welcome to Dig Deep, the mining podcast. In this podcast, we go deep into mining news, hot topics, and live interviews with mining professionals and leading figures in the mining industry. Introducing your host, Rob Tyson, founder and director of Mining International and Mining International Executive, a leading global mining recruitment and headhunting agency.
Hi, mining community. Welcome back to another episode of the Dig Deep, the mining podcast. And today's guest is Graham Stanway, who's the founder, chairman of the company State of Play, who are a global research platform which publishes the largest global survey on strategy and innovation in the resources sector. And have recently released a report with a number of key insights about the external trends impacting our industry and how the industry is innovating and adapting to these strategies and business models as a result. Graham has gained extensive business and consulting experience in strategy and innovation and large-scale transformation, covering mainly mining and energy commodities. And he's here today to talk about, obviously, the company, about innovation, transformation, and mining as a brand in our industry, which I know needs to be improved on. So that's welcome, Graham, to the podcast. How are you going, Graham?
Yeah, good. Thanks, Rob. Glad to have a chat with you this afternoon. Well, this morning, your time.
Yeah, morning, my time, afternoon, your time. So, yeah, again, as we always start these podcasts off, I wonder if you just tell us a little bit about yourself, about your career, and about your background. Before we talk more about the company State of Play and obviously what you do and what you've been finding.
Yeah, thanks, Rob. Look, grew up in South Australia, studied civil engineering, worked designing multi-story buildings for the predecessor of Oricon Structural Engineering, did a PhD in mechanics, structural mechanics, Imperial College in England, and got into submarine building after that, strangely enough, for quite a while. And then Rio Tinto, or Hammersley Iron as it was, had a capability program and came and joined them, which was a great 12 years in strategy and operations, working in high smelt and different things. But really my career changed when I worked with Phil Mitchell and Sam Walsh on setting up a innovation skunkworks in Hammersley Iron, or Rio Tinto Iron Ore, which was a precursor to a lot of the remote operations, the automation, the big expansions. And that happened at a time when China was just taking or about to take off. I think they're only planning to do about 65, 70 million tons into the future, and Rio Tinto Iron Ore. And then that was radically increased. And the technology was just happening then as well. So we had a big impact there. And then following that, set up I was founding partner of a global company called VCI, which did big change design and strategy work. And that's gradually sort of led me to our current businesses, which is Slate Advisory and State of Play. State of Play is the research arm of the business, as you say. Yeah. So that's really my journey. Yeah.
Yeah. So I just wondering if you can just tell us about State of Play and obviously what you guys do.
Yeah, so State of Play, its vision is really just to understand, deeply understand strategy, strategic forces and strategic design in the resources industry. I think it was set up about 10 years ago because there's a lot of understanding on strategy and innovation in fast-moving, industries, digital in particular, but very little on capital-intensive industries where they're closely related to communities, which mining is, amongst others, because the timeframes are so long in terms of innovation and cycles. And so we started a survey, but that really took off. So now runs the big survey that's just been released, and also does drill downs around major issues, collaborative strategy pieces, if you like, when multiple companies and institutions want to get together and do strategy work. So I've done them on cybersecurity and critical minerals and electrification, which led to that consortium and different countries and so on. So combination of the big survey and insights and benchmarking underlying that as well, which companies do, and then the major drill down works.
How do you think carbon-based price differential for critical minerals will manifest itself in the future?
That's really interesting, that one. I think a survey, I think, showed that well over 60% of people thought that there would be a green premium, if you like. But when you talk to people, they're very sceptical. And the scepticism comes from a lot of, I'd say, probably experienced people that have, you know, worked in things like tantalum and other areas and tried to sort of achieve a green premium in their developments with technology companies and not being able to do it. So people think there will be, but there's a lot of scepticism. And how it'll play out, I mean, I'd offer probably a couple of things, Rob, in terms of a scenario. It's just one. But what I'd expect is probably a discount, or a discount if there's not provenance, no. You know, a bit like clean skin wines, if you like. You know, so there'll be a provenance differential. But when the provenance is known, I'd expect a sort of fairly small market for high-end premium, you know, super green stuff, you know, example, you know, steel into, you know, clean steel into high-end cars, but then the bulk to get most of its premium through the you know, known provenance, but probably not a large premium, but a little bit like food, if you like. So two markets, if you like, and then a small premium at the top end. But that's just a scenario. It could flow out many different ways. I think we've also asked about, you know, how this will be verified and so on, and our respondents sort of talked a lot about blockchain being the highest ranked way in terms of this being certified, which was interesting.
Obviously, you recently released this report. Was there any surprises to you?
It's an interesting question. I guess a lot of things, the trends are slow moving. But I think the big surprise for me is how much, if you look at the, stand back and look at asking questions about what major trends are going to drive the industry, energy's just gone through the roof in the last 5 years from a very small, I mean, typically people thought what would shape the industry would be technology and environment. And that's been pretty static in the two biggest ones, which is natural, but energy's come from a fairly small expectation to being the biggest. So that's happened in a fairly short space of time. So not, I think the quantum of that change in perception's been astounding, really. You know, and there's a few other things in the external drivers, which are continuous that I can talk about later. I mean, the Asian perception one has dropped right off, which is I can you know, chat about that later too. But yeah, the energy one's really, really gone through the roof.
Yeah, well, I suppose we can speak about that now. I mean, what do you think about the rest of the world sort of underestimating the impact of the Asian economy development on the future of global economy?
Well, I think it's fascinating. I think, I mean, because there's probably two parts that, Rob, is why has it happened? What are people missing? But I think what's happened is it had such a huge impact from 2000, you know, 5, 6 through to 13 or 14, where, you know, China's crude steel production went from, you know, I think almost less than 100 million tons to a billion tons. So it was super big transformation, and that's peaked and is sort of arguably declining slightly. So people, that whole impactful story has settled down. So I think that's one reason. But the other reason why people are not so focused on it, I think, is that a lot of the attention shifted to, you know, equities in the US and technology and so on, and that story of, you know, China's struggled in that respect as well on the equity market. So there's been a couple of factors of perceived maturation and shift in economic focus elsewhere. But if you look at Asia, I mean, you know, Korea, Japan, China, that's where most of the gigafactories are being built. I think Indonesia is headed to the fourth biggest economy in the world, potentially. India's, you know, got very large growth, 1.4 billion people. Most of the middle class is going to come from Asia. And China's still a huge leader in AI and electric vehicles. So if you think about what will impact the resources industry, the story is still very much Asian, both from a technology perspective and a demand perspective. So I think we'll see, see much more focus on that in the coming years in terms of both opportunities and what's driving the industry.
Yeah. I want to talk about branding, and I speak about branding to many executives that I speak to in the industry. And And I believe it is obviously a big issue in our industry. Do you think I guess from your research, do you think that the mining industry needs to be more focused on obviously marketing of the mining industry from a, I suppose, a branding perspective, maybe from a product perspective, or anything else? I mean, what has your sort of research indicated?
Yeah, I mean, part of it's from our research, part of it's from just our strategic knowledge. But I think if you split those two things from like product marketing and branding as a company or an industry, I'll chat about the product while separate them out because they're a bit different. But from a product perspective, I think there's value that's on the table that mining companies don't get, mostly because they're so focused on, on the ore body and development of, focused in a different direction, if you like, than, say, a product manufacturer. But, and also because margins are really driven by the nature of the ore body and cycles. So, they're either very big or, not so big. Whereas, so if you compare, but then if so, therefore, the marketing in our data has shown that it's a low priority for innovation, like one of the lower priorities. I think only community is lower, so it's, which isn't good. So it's, what that means is money's left on the table. And if you compare mining, say, to chemicals, the DuPonts or the Dows of the world or the agricultural businesses like, JBS and Cargill, the analytics in those industries on, product decision making and market allocation is much more sophisticated than that which is adopted in mining, which means there's a certain amount of value that's left on the table. Which I think is an issue. And then the other thing with green premium coming, there's another, one or two, or, there's another percentage point or so that is available through product marketing. So I think it's, yes, there should be more focus. There's value left on the table, but it's a question of how you get that. We can only focus on so many things. So on the perception side, that's on the company branding side, mining's got, well, from our research on, it's got a very negative perception. And this is from the people in the industry. I think 76%. So it's negatively perceive it negatively, and or so it's seen as being perceived negatively. So, what do you do as a company? I mean, the industry image is a hard thing to change. Big challenge. So, as a specific company, you need to separate, and you can do that. And I would do that, for recruiting and capital reasons and approvals reasons, lots of reasons for doing that. And there's various mechanisms for that, but there's got to be substance behind it because the trust levels are quite low. So it's not a, that's not just a, sort of a set of branding issue. It's, the branding has to be backed up with delivery as well.
Yeah. It's interesting that you said 60 to 70% of the people within the industry sees the perception of mining as negativity. So they're obviously everyone's aware of it. But how do we change that? I suppose we, the 60 or 70%, can change that. And I suppose it's a shift in mindset. That obviously we can change that within our industry, but obviously what we also need is people outside of the industry to then change their perception. But I suppose it starts within before it starts outside.
We would like to be able to do work on, the external perceptions as well. There is an argument we might be harder than others, but I don't think so. And that's just a hypothesis. So what do you do about it? I think the knee jerk, well, not the knee jerk, a reaction is to say, well, we need to communicate harder and tell people we're not so bad, right? But that's maybe not the first place to look because people with the negative perceptions would say you would say that. I think the industry is challenged because of the connection with coal in a lot of ways. Some of our sub data has shown that a lot of that negative perception comes by the mining industry being lumped together. So base metals versus coal. So how do you segment the industry? And the other issue is it's such a global industry, you can never set standards fully for, I mean, you know, there's always going to be sort of rogue players or players that are not, you know, not the standards aren't acceptable in any industry, but we mining more than any other gets, you know, homogenized. So I think that's part of the issue. Mining's got a lot to contribute to the green transition, you know. So I think that's a big source of the story in terms of changing perceptions. You know, it leads the world in. I mean, some of the gold mines, for example, are going to be pushing 80% renewable penetration. How many heavy industries get close to that? It's led the way in a lot of automation and tech. So I think more of that and publicity around that, as well as the segmentation, would be helpful. And it's, you know, people are well aware of the broad issues, but I'd say lead harder at some of those things where we can be seen positively.
Yeah. Also, you mentioned communities was very low on the list. I just wonder if you can expand on that.
Well, it's low on the list in terms of where people focus innovation. So I think, which is not good, you know, I think there's a lot of room there to, and there's a lot of positive space in that respect. And I think, you know, it's not my area of expertise, but I suspect there could be a lot more done on business models, innovative business models up front. Mostly the community is seen as an approvals issue or a hurdle to be overcome or
especially with the ESG. So that's why I wanted to raise that point, because with ESG becoming more at the forefront of what mining companies should focus on, that's why I just wanted to find out what you meant by the community's low down the list.
Yeah, it's when people think about innovation, it's not the first place they'll go. You know, they'll go to other places much more ahead of that. So, which is, I think, a potential issue. You maybe flip that around.
Obviously, different mining companies have different risk profiles. Are there any particular where you're seeing businesses we accept sort of more risk or areas where they're more risk averse?
Yeah, the data is really, this is probably one of my favorite, you know, sort of areas of the data. I think where you'll see most companies prepared to take risk, most mining companies, is when it's related to ore body acquisition. So exploration, they'll take risk, or acquisition or partnering. It's all the stuff around how do I, you know, get more ore, which is, you know, what a mining business is. Where it starts to diverge, where the companies diverge depending on the business model, is whether they'll operate in, you know, some developing countries, or how global they'll be, you know, and whether they'll build mines or not, or buy them off others. And there's been companies in the public domain saying, look, I won't operate in these countries, and or different companies saying, look, we won't actually build mines because the risk is too much, and we'll actually buy them from others. So that's the bifurcation there. When you get to the low end, it's really interesting. The lowest things, you know, out of 10, you know, the number 9 and 10 is anything to do with ore body risk or asset design, which is a challenge with the energy change because deteriorating ore bodies, because with the energy shift, you know, it's going to require changes in asset design, you know, different types of equipment and different mine designs. So you really have an innovation issue in mining in terms of the core area where you need to take some risk is where we naturally won't go. The other thing I'd say is from a competitive position, if you're prepared to take risk where others aren't, that's where the upside is if you're good at it. So if you're innovative around, you know, difficult ore bodies or innovative around asset design, and there's a lot of opportunity there, then, you know, and you have the capability, and there's companies that do that, that's where there's some upside. But mostly, I think, in risk, mining's really unfairly, within the industry, sometimes categorised as conservative, because it's not when you actually think about the risk that it takes. It's just that when you get to those areas I talked about, you know, most of the risk quotient's been used up. But it's a very interesting area.
What's the sort of current time frame for innovation within our industry, and how is this impacting the ability for the industry to undertake large transformational innovations?
Well, the data is pretty clear on this, that about 80% in our industry, the innovation timeframes are 5 years and less, and most commonly around a three-year perspective, which is not, I don't think it's typically unusual with other industries, but it's pretty clear and it's been consistent over the decade that we've done that. The challenge with mining is that most of the innovation, a lot of the really highly impactful innovation is physical innovation, extraction, project related things, heavy capital related innovations, energy. They're all physical things which take, decades often to develop. So there's a bit of a mismatch there. The things that really transform the industry are not particularly attractive or within the timeframe of most companies to drive. There's not a unique issue either. I mean, if you look at venture capital funds, they very rarely invest in any physical technologies or digital technologies. So that's the sort of challenge we've got in mining. But then, so if we're going to transform to, low energy, low footprint, mines that can extract, lower quality ore bodies, that we need long time frames of innovation. So it sort of says, well, how do you deal with that? That's a difficult challenge, but it's probably a combination of, government, the larger companies, and innovators and researchers working more closely together, and financiers. But, you have this issue of long time frame. We're seeing it playing out now in lots of areas, to do with the energy transformation. I mean, the other challenge you have, where you see it done better, is generally with private companies or family-owned companies. So the Cargills of the world, or FMG or MinRes, and those companies where there's more concentrated ownership, and they'll be able to take longer term, back physical innovations or different innovations for a longer period. And generally across the board, public companies have a challenge, beyond a real challenge in really actually investing beyond 5 years in a lot of these things. And I'm not talking about mining, I'm just talking about generally.
And I suppose an area that interests me more, being a headhunter and a search consultant, is obviously our industry trying to attract talent. And I wondered what the current issues are at the moment, obviously from your research that you've done, and from those issues, how would you say we could overcome some of the issues in terms of attracting talent and people to our industry?
Well, I've talked about the perception issue, so that's a challenge. I mean, when you think about the shortage, you sort of have to be rational about it too. So you firstly want to attract more people to the industry, and I've talked about the different mechanisms for changing perception and probably spreading the net a bit more widely. So that's a lot of it comes back to that. The other thing is making, sort of looking beyond the industry, trying to make the jobs independent of the mining industry. If you look at the very low rates of mining engineering graduates, then you're never going to fill that gap. So you have to look at either, functionalizing those roles so they can be done by people not trained as mining people, or through other services companies, or retraining people from other industries. And then I think a big part of it will just be, using robotics and AI to actually remove jobs that you can't find people to do, take the work out, getting smarter about design of assets and equipment so that they don't require, the sort of skills that you can't find, right? So that'll all happen, but happen gradually. So yeah, design them out, try and defunctional, deminify it if you like, and get the perceptions right. But ultimately, supply meets demand, so you're not going to sit there with a big gap. Companies are very good at innovating quickly to find different ways of getting talent, using diverse sources, or using workforce globally, or looking elsewhere. So I think you'll see the shortage will drive a lot of innovation in itself. It'll be very interesting to watch.
And do you think there is a skill shortage in our industry? And the reason why I asked that question is I did have a little bit of a debate on LinkedIn with a comment that I a post that I put out there, and a comment where someone did comment to say that there isn't a skill shortage and we should forget about that. And I said, well, I believe there is. From your research, do you believe there is a skill shortage within the mining industry?
Yeah, I mean, well, when we talk to people, I mean, through the Electric Mine Consortium and other activities that we're working on, that's a big topic that comes up. They'll talk about remote areas that need certain standards for electricians, and they need three times the current ones they've got, and they've still got vacancies currently. So there's lots of hard evidence that there's quite large shortages in different areas, and not being able to get people. So yeah, I mean it's certainly there, but there is a counter argument. Supply always meets demand, so if they can't get them, it's a question of how much is development or throughput or capacity constrained. If we had more skills, would projects be actually accelerating faster? And I think they probably would. You talk to people, they'll back off certain developments and certain things because they know that the skills risk will be there. I mean, we've seen that even with the decarbonisation effort, where people won't go quite as hard at electrification because they know if they do this, they won't be able to find the resources to run it. So it's a risk-based decision not to transform. But it's also probably a risk-based decision not to develop sometimes if they don't believe they'll be able to get the skills. So yeah, it's definitely there. But in general, and then it's going to get harder too with some of these technology and decarbonisation transformations
Yeah.
in
And
certain
again,
aspects.
what I see is a lot of older people leaving our industry and not the same amount of people, younger people coming into the industry. So there's people leaving the industry and not enough people coming into the industry, which will then shrink the pool of people within our industry. So there surely would be skill shortages there. Any evidence or research that you've done without the older generation moving out of our industry?
No, we haven't done the balance of that, but it is, I mean, two comments I'd make about the demographics. One is we did do, and we haven't published much of it yet, but if people are interested, we can do it. Looked at the demographic perceptions, and when we, when you talk about diversity, and you'd often split things up by geography, which is, which is sort of country of nationality, gender, or age, by far, geography actually dictates people's responses and perceptions much more than gender, and age is much more than geography. So there's radically different views depending on age. And so you're going to get, if there's a rapid influx of a rapid exit of older people or eventual exit, there'll be quite a different perception within the industry. The other thing I'd make, so that the perceptions are very different depending on age. The other comment I'd make is when you do, anecdotally, you talk to people about when they're in the high risk situations of developing projects, it just require a lot of experience, or you're at difficult operational issues. That's where there's a shortage, and I think anecdotally you hear of productivity or costs being an issue in project developments and certain operating situations because that experience isn't there. So that'll, yeah, but what it, how, the question is how that will manifest in terms of how people design projects and what they go ahead with. But yeah, I mean, I'd agree with that comment about there being sort of a not a mass balance, if you like, of the ages going through the industry. I mean, people are quite reluctant to go to sites as well too, so that's something that there's always been a challenge, but there's been a really big demographic shift there. Fortunately, remote operations or this type of work has become much more accepted in the last 4 years, which has alleviated that to an extent.
How do you see the energy profile of mining companies changing over the next sort of decade or so? Obviously, you mentioned obviously energy. You've seen a big shift in innovation within energy. How do you see it changing over the next 10 years?
Yeah, that's fascinating. We ask a question, a longitudinal question, have over the last 5 or 6 years on where people, or 3 to 4 years, where people think that the energy will come from in their operations and their mining businesses over the next 15 years. So get to look at 15 years. So where's the energy going to come from? And by far the biggest expectation is solar. I think at about 80%. And wind is rapidly increasing to be the second, I think the second one, but that's increased more recently in the last few surveys. And mostly that's driven by, you know, solar's the place where people go first because it's cheaper, and then wind because it's 24, that's around the clock, although intermittent. So they're, you know, it's very much a renewables future. And you know, we're seeing designs and actual mines being put in place with 75%, you know, renewable penetration or more, and on the drawing board for more. There's some other interesting, more recent developments. I mean, obviously, all of the fossil fuel sources, gas, coal, diesel, are dropping off pretty fast in terms of expectations. But there's a couple of little kickers just in the last survey, and one was synthetic or green fuels has popped up a bit more, and nuclear a little bit more, both small, but have really ticked up in the last survey. And I think recognition of a couple of things. One is the challenge with mobile equipment, but also that's just that last 20%. Once the renewables get to a certain level, what's going to, you know, fossil fuels do phase out. But this is the mining industry talking about itself, and so it's very much a renewables future, with very high penetration rates, you know, up to around 80% or more.
And lastly, just wondered if there's anything else that you wanted to add, and is there any, I suppose, thoughts around what research you may be looking to do in the future? Over the course of this year, is any particular areas of research that you're looking to focus on within our mining industry over this year?
Yeah, there's, I mean, that'll be driven by, you know, people who want to do collaborative stuff. So once we get often intersection of government or multiple companies who want to do that together, that's how that'll work. But some of the areas that we're quite interested in is, one is this physical innovation area. You know, there's a, how we can accelerate that, you know, what are the mechanisms for accelerating that vis-a-vis digital innovation, and you know, what are some of the most effective models, because they've been quite fragmented. We're looking closely at potentially a green premium, and even working with the tech sector itself. So this is, you know, like the semiconductor area and that. And really trying to look for different models that, well, what sort of models could accelerate an incentive to provide clean supply chains. You know, so that's, for instance, a couple of the areas that we're looking at. And also the other couple of areas, these are all sort of on the drawing board with so if people are interested, radical compression of project timeframes. So you were looking at, you know, everyone, when you go to a lot of conferences and talk to people, sort of we bemoan the fact that it's sort of, you know, about 15 years from finding something to operations, and we need to really compress that, but we see that extending, so that needs some radical rethinking. And then the other is just the energy area. So there's a world where you know, downstream processing coupled with, you know, thermal energy and renewables could sort of radically decarbonize, but also, you know, provide a baseload set of power. So those sort of energy downstream processing structures are something we're interested in, and potentially even another perceptions, a deeper external view on perceptions. But as I said, they're all sort of you know, on the drawing board, drill down type things, and we'll also pull apart the current survey that's just gone out from different perspectives as well.
Ryan, really appreciate your time. Thank you for sharing your views, and obviously on a lot of research that you've done in a variety of different areas and of our industry. And it's good to understand what other people are thinking, and maybe looking at what we can do to change and innovate. So really appreciate your time. If our audience wants to reach out to you, if obviously they want to grab the report that you've just recently released, how can they go about doing that? Also, are you on other social media platforms where people can follow obviously what you guys do and research that you put out there?
Yeah, so I mean, people can connect with me at Graham at stateofplay.org. Can go to the website and download the report. It's free. A lot of valuable stuff in there, and yeah, please get in contact. And we're on LinkedIn as well. Please get in contact if you've got any questions.
Yeah, certainly. And we'll include all that in the show notes anyway, for easy access. So, yeah, Graham, really appreciate your time. Perhaps you want to come on next year and give us an update on any other research that you've uncovered over the course of this year. Be great for you to come on, and it'd be good to sort of really understand what people are doing and their thought process and their changes over a course of a year.
No problem, and good luck with your podcast. It's always really enjoyed them, and yours in particular, and yeah, people like yourself doing this is really, really good for knowledge dissemination and learning. So thanks.
Really appreciate that. Yeah, and as always, sort of talk when I talk to people about the podcast, this is an educational platform, and basically I want people to be educated in various different subjects that can be related to our industry. So yeah, really, really appreciate your comments there. So hope you the audience there enjoyed the episode. A lot to unpack there. So please, as always, share these episodes far and wide with people in our industry, and also obviously people outside of our industry as well, where you might be able to tempt them to come into the mining industry. So thank you for your time, and until next time, happy mining.
Thank you for listening. Remember to reach out to Rob via the show notes, and be sure to subscribe and leave a review. Until next time, happy mining, helping each other to improve the mining industry.